This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Election Day just a month away, and yet it promises to be the longest month of your life. Vice presidential candidates Tim Kaine and Mike Pence sparred this week in their only debate. The meeting showed the role of the VP candidates and how they can be both attackers and defenders. The presidential candidates will meet for their second and final debate this weekend in St. Louis. Meanwhile, the North Carolina Senate race is heating up, and several polls show incumbent Richard Burr and challenger Deborah Ross in a dead heat. Joining me now, as he often does, is political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Frank. Actually, there are two more presidential debates. We have one Sunday, and then we have the final one October 19th. So we have two more presidentials. And then we'll see what happens on November 8th.
Just wishful thinking on my part, Ken, but we'll correct you.
I'm enjoying the debates. I really am. I mean, I know the VP debate didn't get as big of a play and big as an audience as the first encounter, the thriller in Hofstra, as we call it. but you know, I think there's a lot of things we learned about both candidates.
Well, let's go back to the VP race. And any clear winner in that race? Or how do you win a vice presidential debate, I guess?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, we always talk about famous debates in history, famous vice presidential debates in history. The most famous one, of course, we always think of Lloyd Benson wiping the floor with Dan Quayle in 1988. You know, I knew Jack Kennedy, you're no Jack Kennedy. But in the end, the Bush-Quayle ticket won 40 out of 50 states, so who won, right? I mean, what does it really matter? Geraldine Ferraro embarrassing the senior George Bush in 1984, and Mondale Ferraro lost 49 states. So you can have great moments in vice presidential debate history, and ultimately what it means in November is another thing altogether. But having said that, it's a very interesting question on this week's VP debate, because on style, on manner, on temperament, I thought Mike Pence was far better. I think he was easier on the ears. I think Tim Kaine was very caffeinated. He was interrupting a lot, and he seemed overly scripted. And, you know, the job, the role of a vice presidential running mate is supposed to be the attack dog. Remember Bob Dole in 1976. But Tim Kaine is not an attack dog kind of guy. But he did everything he can to get under Mike Pence's skin and try to put daylight between Pence and Donald Trump. And we've learned during the debate that there's plenty of that.
Well, and it tells us a little bit about this race. And in other races, the vice presidential candidates may have wanted to distinguish themselves. After all, they're only a heartbeat away. And so they're talking about themselves and who they are. But in this debate, it was very clearly they were surrogates for their presidential candidate, their running mate. And that was the tone it took. And Tim Kaine, of course, as you said, went on the attack, asking Mike Pence to defend Donald Trump. And here's a little bit of how that went.
Six times tonight, I have said to Governor Pence, I can't imagine how you can defend your running mate's position on one issue after the next. And in all six cases, he's refused to defend
his
running
mate's position. No, don't put words in my mouth.
And yet, he is asking everybody to vote for somebody that he cannot defend. And I just think that should be underlined.
All right, gentlemen, let's talk about Russia.
I'm very, very happy to defend Donald Trump.
I will give you an opportunity to do that.
I'll take them one at a time.
More nations should get nuclear weapons.
Don't
try to defend that.
Well, he never said that, Senator.
He has absolutely said it. Saudi Arabia, South Korea, Japan.
Gentlemen, Russia.
Just as an aside, Ken, the next time I'm involved in an argument trying to break it up, that's what I'm going to say. I say, let's just talk about Russia.
Well, you know something? I heard a third voice in there. I didn't know there was a moderator there. Right? I heard this third voice. Look, you know, the thing that struck me just now when you said that, Frank, is that you say that the two VP candidates are supposed to be surrogates for the lead top of the ticket, and that's true. But as we just heard Tim Kaine effectively make the point that it's hard to make the case that Mike Pence was a surrogate for Donald Trump because, one, he criticized Vladimir Putin, and, of course, you know you can't do that if you're Donald Trump. And, two, asking him to defend things like about his taxes and birtherisms and views about women, well, Mike Pence absolutely didn't do that. And several times Tim Kaine said, well, Trump says X, Y, or Z, And Pence said, no, he didn't, but he did say it. Right. And I guess Pence was in a very unenviable position of trying to defend a candidate that he doesn't always clearly want to defend.
By the way, Secretary of State Kerry today said that Putin should be investigated for war crimes as a war criminal. So there's a sharp divide on the Putin vote in this country.
Within the Republican Party.
Within the Republican Party as well. Let's talk more about surrogates, though, because obviously the vice presidential candidate has to, that's the stand-in role, but others as well. President Obama is scheduled to be in Greensboro on Tuesday. He's got at least two events scheduled. He's obviously pressing for the Hillary Clinton's presidency. How big a role do they play? And what about a lame duck president? How important is a Barack Obama to Hillary Clinton these days?
Well, the fact is that President Obama's numbers, approval numbers, have gone up, and that's good news for the Democratic ticket. And plus the fact that Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama remain extremely popular among Democrats. And so look where these people are campaigning: in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania, in Florida. Another surrogate, Bernie Sanders, is campaigning in New Hampshire. So obviously, you know, we like to think of this as a national election, but we all know that there are only 8 states in the country that matter. And certainly North Carolina is one of them. So the Obamas are clearly doing everything they can to make sure that Hillary Clinton wins. And it's interesting because if you remember the Democratic convention, the first time Michelle Obama mentioned Hillary Clinton's name, she got booed. I mean, obviously, the Democratic Party wasn't as united back then, with the Bernie-crats still being very upset, the DNC, you know, the WikiLeaks leaks and all that stuff. But right now, the Democratic Party seems much more united than the Republican Party.
Well, Michelle Obama, I mean, let's stick with her for a minute, because she, you know, is being called the closer in many cases. She's a very effective campaigner by all accounts.
I thought she gave a spectacular speech at the convention in Philadelphia. I mean, remember, you know, when they go low, we go high. I mean, these are just things memorable. Hillary Clinton, for all her strengths and weaknesses, she is not the greatest speaker. I think Michelle Obama really just, you know, blows them away whenever she gives a speech. She's been a very, very effective surrogate.
We'll give a little sample of that right here.
We also need someone who is steady and measured, because when making life or death, war or peace decisions, a president can't just pop off or lash out irrationally. And I think we can all agree that someone who's roaming around at 3 a.m. tweeting should not have their fingers on the nuclear codes. We need someone who's honest and plays by the rules, because not paying taxes for years and years while the rest of us pay our fair share doesn't make you smarter than the rest of us.
First Lady Michelle Obama at a Clinton campaign event in Charlotte earlier this week. So following her tells us, if we didn't know already, where the big battles are being fought, right?
Absolutely. Those states I mentioned earlier are exactly the case. And, of course, Republicans will say, well, honest and play by the rules. I don't know if that defines Hillary Clinton either. And Republicans will run against Hillary Clinton as somebody who's not the most honest person in the world. But, look, I'm not going to play this game of false equivalency here. Whatever you think of Hillary Clinton and the false there, I mean, there are Republicans as well who will list everything about Donald Trump. And look at Donald Trump since the last debate, his attacks on Miss Universe, Miss Piggy, he called her, Miss Housekeeping, so we don't forget that she's Latina, and talking about how Hillary Clinton is responsible for the birther issue. It's just beyond the pale. And again, we have 32 days to go, and yet this race is still very, very close. Hillary Clinton said the other day, I can't believe I'm not 50 points ahead, and Democrats probably agree, but this election is no slam dunk by any means.
No slam dunk for the president. It should have been a slam dunk for incumbent Republican Senator Richard Burr, who's running for re-election. It isn't. He's in a neck-and-neck race with Deborah Ross, his Democratic challenger. Tell me more about that race.
That is a stunner. I mean, if we're talking about possible shockers on November 8th in the Senate, you have to watch North Carolina. Look, I don't think Richard Burr has done anything wrong in his term in the Senate, but he has not responded aggressively. He's pretty much, he just sits back and just expects him to win. But there's a new commercial out that seems to be taking over the race. Basically, that Deborah Ross opposed a North Carolina sex offender registry in the 1990s when she was ahead of the ACLU, and of course, she said that's not true. I fought to strengthen it and blah, blah, blah. So they're going back on that. But Burr has been, I mean, this is his nature. He's not an aggressive campaigner. He's always had pretty much easy elections when he runs. But this is a shocking, it's very, very close. And obviously, the fact that Hillary Clinton is showing strength in North Carolina, the fact that Governor Pat McCrory is probably trailing in his bid for reelection, it's not a great year for the Republican Party in North Carolina. And it's possible, I don't think it's going to happen, but certainly Burr is being pulled down by that anti-Republican tide.
And we're seeing a lot of money being spent on that race and the governor's race.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact is that from the beginning, for the longest time, the Democrat, Roy Cooper, has been outraising the incumbent Republican governor. I mean, when a challenger outraises an incumbent, that usually is a bad sign for the incumbent. But, I mean, but we've said that on your show for a long time, McCrory is just, you know, being pulled in so many different directions between the very conservative state legislature and the business community that just hates HB2, hates the fact that the state has resulted in boycott and sports boycotts in North Carolina. You can fool around about anything else, but you don't fool around when it comes to sports in North Carolina. And McCrory could very well pay the price on Election Day.
Ken Rudin, political junkie. Ken, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
All right. Ken Rudin is going to stay with us, by the way. We are going to take a look at who Robert Strauss, a historian and writer, thinks is the worst president ever. Spoiler alert, it was James Buchanan. And we'll find out why in a moment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.